everybody. Welcome back. Another episode of Bootstrap Web. Brian, how are you? Nice to see you.
Doing good, buddy. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. It's Friday. It was a good week. The weather has turned. It's 65 and sunny in Portland. Things are positive. It started off as a bad week, but we'll get into that, you know, going from bad to good thing.
You know, the weather this time of year here in the Northeast is... It's a roller coaster ride. Today it's nice and sunny, but it's been raining all week and it looks beautiful outside. And then you step outside and it's still freaking cold.
Yeah. Yep. We've got MicroConf coming up in less than 2 weeks. We try to get a bunch done before that happens. We've got some interesting updates. We're going to talk about Derek Reamer's business level as our breakdown.
We're going to continue our march to try and run everybody else's businesses from afar.
I like this. We are completely unaccountable. We get to have fun with it, and there are no consequences whatsoever for being wrong. This is how we like it.
Mm-hmm. I don't even really know what Derek is building, but it sounds kind of interesting. And I think you and I both spoke to him about his research process. So
I did not talk to him in his interview process, but I'm fascinated by what he's doing.
Okay.
Yeah. Besides that, I want to talk about something more personal. It's still business, but it's personal outside of Cardhook. So that could be interesting to some people. And how about you? What do you have going on?
As we were talking offline just before this, I am in like full on frantic, hectic mode. And I usually don't like this sort of thing.
Not your MO.
It's not me. But I'm putting things in place. Like all this work I know will pay off. It's not just like one-off project work that'll never happen again. I know that I am frantically putting things in place that will eventually form a system that I could step back from and the system will keep running. That's what I'm working on.
And you have that initial demand to fuel you through whatever you need to get done.
Yeah. So I'm talking about the Audience Ops podcasting service. As of today, there are 7 paying clients on that and a few more who are, you know, ready to sign up. Part of the stress here is that MicroConf is coming up in like 10 days from now. So I'll only be away for 3 days, but that's 3 days where I will not even really be on email. Like at MicroConf, I'm totally occupied all day long and all night. So it's like, I won't be able to do anything from the trip. So before then, I need to get, we have 4 podcast producers who I've just hired this past week. Next week, I need to hire at least 1 or 2 audio editors. I need to hire a designer. Kat and I are deciding on 2 writers to bring on the team. We need to get all those new people starting to get trained and onboarded. And on the podcasting side, we're also just starting to kick off the first few clients next week. Some are kind of still in like a waiting list period, but 2 or 3 will be actually kicking off next week.
And we're recording podcasts next week.
Like a planning call.
This has been pretty fast. I think, you know, when we look back at it, if you record next week,
we're not recording podcasts next week. We're just doing their planning call next week, and then probably record the following week.
When are you collecting money? Have you already collected money?
So, like those 7 clients have all paid for their first month. They pay for that up front. So normally it'll be just like our writing service where they pay up front for the first month and then about 30 days later they begin the monthly service. For these early pilot clients, they just paid the first month and then we're waiting until they have first episodes ready to publish. And because things are coming together, that'll probably be like a 6 to 8 week period before we actually like get to that second month onward. You know,
this is adding a new line of business, a new line of revenue to an existing agency or an existing service. Really interesting to look back on it from like, okay, idea, outreach, validation, and then go.
I'm not super transparent about numbers generally, but like this early on, I don't mind. I mean, we've added 10K MRR to the business like in the last 30 days, you know, just with this.
I love these situations. We'll talk about it when I want to talk about like the when one door gets closed, another gets open sort of thing. When you get put into a spot of like, damn, I need to figure something out. And the stuff you come up with it's always been there, right? You could have done this a year ago, but what is it about these situations that like puts you into this corner and then you get creative?
Yeah. You know, a lot of it is like, it's low hanging fruit. It's also like a logical next step. I talked about this before with Audience Ops, but The reason why I'm able to go so fast right now, I just wrote this to the newsletter, we can reuse so much. We have infrastructure in place, processes in place. I can duplicate and tweak. What I found is harder than I expected is getting the people on board.
Oh, so the people is the hard part. What do you know?
I know. Well, to be honest though, in all of the other roles that I've hired for, so writers, even project managers, virtual assistants, copy editors, audio editors for my other podcast, all of those roles are actually pretty easy to hire for if you've done them before. Because we literally have hundreds of applicants of writers all the time. And we've got a really great process of vetting them and hiring them and onboarding them. But the podcast producer role,
what is that affecting that supply? Is that because you can work from home and that's just very attractive?
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many writers in the world. But the other thing just generally is that there are, not enough people talk about this, but there are so many really talented, really smart, really motivated people. They just want to work remotely. They want to have flexible schedules. They don't even necessarily want a full-time job. They just want a part-time retainer, ongoing, steady, but 15, 20 hours a week because they're a stay-at-home mom or dad, or because they are a freelancer and they do other stuff, or they travel full-time. Like, there are so many, they're super, super talented people. And so many companies still operate in this like more traditional mindset of like, oh, we're a company, like we have to offer all these like benefits and full-time salaries and everything. And it's like
the value people put on that freedom. I mean, I'm going to talk about it again when I talk about that personal business side. That's one of the big factors I'm getting into it, is because for my wife, that's really the only option. For her to go to a 9-to-5 job right now with a 2-year-old is just a mess. And the take-home income is like negligible because you have to pay for childcare. You'd really be a lot better off with 20 hours a week writing.
Yeah.
Much better.
Yeah. I mean, you can make the argument like, oh, they're not fully committed to your company and this and that. But like, I haven't seen that. I mean,
you can also make the argument that they're appreciative of the opportunity and how flexible they have their situation. It's great.
Dude, we have 24 people on the team at Audience Ops. Over half of them have been on the team for more than 2 years.
Which is not normal.
Some of them as long as 3 years. Like,
right. If they were unhappy, they would stop.
They wouldn't be there. And you know, it's steady, reliable, and it's good work. It's not like they get to do really creative work, and we've got awesome systems and processes so that it removes all the crap. Like, they don't have to.
And the fact that they don't even deal with clients directly so much is phenomenal, because that's what you assume. My wife used to do PR. For her to do freelance PR and start working with clients, it's not that fun to work with clients that way. It's just a lot. It's draining. It's a lot of energy. It's a lot of tests. Anyway, okay, so let's get back on track here.
So anyway, that's basically occupying all of my time between now and the time I fly to Vegas. So
I'm looking forward to, you know, when it turns. I mean, it already sounds like it's already turning with the service starting. 10K MRR, such a short period of time. It's very impressive. It's awesome.
Yeah, cool. What's up on your end?
Okay, so I don't want to beat around the bush. I'm going to get right into it. And what I want to do is talk through some of the logic. So what I'm doing is I'm getting into a little bit of coaching. It's something I haven't really thought about. And then all of a sudden, the past few like weeks and months, it started popping up in my head. Right. So let's think about some of this logic.
Take us through why the thought to go into coaching and what do you plan to do with it?
Yeah. So we have two coaches in the business. Right now in Carhook. We have a CTO coach named Ron, and he and I do a 1-hour call every week along with Rock, our VP of engineering, and he just kind of works with us on that tech process and helping Rock transition from developer to manager and helping me as a CEO understand what I need to look for in that role, what I need to provide for that person to give them the best chance of success. So he just kind of helps us, very focused on that specific piece. And then we have another coach on the marketing side. This guy, Sid Barath, he's done marketing with a bunch of other companies, has a bunch of e-commerce experience. He and I worked together like 3 years ago on some content stuff. And what he does, he and I meet for 1 hour a week along with Ed, who's our senior marketer, and he helps us with that marketing process. Right? We've talked about it before, like having a bunch of experiments loaded up and what's coming up this week, and then looking back and eliminating experiments that aren't working and doubling down on the ones that, so just formalizing that process. So we do a 1 hour call every week with them, and the amount of value we get is incredible. And it's interesting and it's fun. And so what I did is I spoke to both of them and told them that I was thinking about it. And they kind of gave me the pros and cons of, like, it's very rewarding. It's more than 1 hour a week. It's not an hour a week. You think about it. And as you're reading blog posts, you're saying, ooh, I wonder if Jordan would find this valuable. So it occupies, like,
I think that's just a really smart move, just to have these two coaches who are, like, focused on those departments in your business. It makes your existing people more productive and efficient. So I think that's awesome.
We felt the need, and then it didn't make sense to hire someone full time. We just needed some help and guidance. And I knew when I hired Ed that I was going to be super busy. And so I wouldn't have the time to focus on marketing and helping Ed be as effective as he could be. So both of these are kind of, they're not really for me. They're for Rock on the engineering side, and they're for Ed on the marketing side, but it also has helped me tremendously in the business overall.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, just knowing you, obviously, and for those listening to this podcast, there's no doubt that you can absolutely add a lot of value as a coach to other founders. We could definitely talk about that in a minute. I think the question that probably most people are thinking about, that I'm thinking about too, is, like, what are your thoughts around the time commitment and just the energy and mind share commitment to this? Like, if you think about what those coaches are doing, they kind of do this maybe not full time, but they have a bunch of coaching clients.
Both of them actually do the same thing, just a small handful of clients. This is not their full-time job. What they tell me is that it keeps them super sharp. It keeps them engaged. It's interesting. And so one of the factors is that I am interested in advising and investing in the future. And this starts to build up that skill set of looking at someone else's business and not just my own, and learning from it and learning how to give advice, and that relationship with the founder, and kind of sympathizing with how stressed they are, and, you know, just being forced to give realistic advice. So I do it all the time, all day. I'm in this incubator here in Portland. We talk constantly. People come up to me and ask, you know, I'm seen as some type of, like, authority given, right? There's a new cohort of companies. So they look up. It's almost like the freshmen looking up at the seniors who live in the fraternity house. I'm literally in the Starbucks office. You know, we've, like, hit $1 million in ARR as a SaaS. So people, like, look up and ask questions. And I like doing it. So I have no doubt that I can provide a lot of value. And then the X factor, right? And there's no beating around the bush. The money in a startup, right? We have investors. So the second you take on investment, one of the biggest issues with taking on investment, first bootstrapping entirely, is that your salary is set in such a way that if you have a great month, you can't just take more money that month because you had a good month. If you're bootstrapping your own business and you have a gangbusters month, you just take an extra 10 grand out because you had a good month. In this environment with investors, you can't do that. I mean, I guess I could ask them if I could take out some, but whatever. But it doesn't.
Yeah, it's like maybe that would be fine, and maybe it wouldn't be. But you also have a team who also need, like, it's not just what you need to pay this month to the team. You got to have that, you know, a couple months runway to, you know.
Right. And the business is the priority. So me taking an extra 5 grand a month might be good for me, but it's not. We should probably hire someone with that money if that's what we have. So anyway, it's one of these things where salary is not tied to your revenue, not in the same way. And so as we've gotten more successful and past that million ARR mark and starting to grow beyond it and so on, I don't think it's smart, given what our needs are, for me to jack up my salary. But I've got three kids, and now it's now the option is what we talked about before. Do you want your wife to go back to work?
Right. And your wife doesn't work.
She doesn't work right now. She's been juggling three kids, and our youngest is 2 years old. So my wife wants to go back to work to, like, have her own thing, which is important. And the income obviously is good too. But it's still a little too early.
Yeah. And my wife is in the same boat. She worked up until we had our first kid, and now she's home with them, you know, full time. And, like, once they both get into school, she'll go back to, you know, doing what she's done. But But until then, it's whatever I can bring home. That's supporting everything.
Exactly right. Yeah. So I think this coaching thing is as efficient a way to add personal income as possible, right? If I go off and we're in the Shopify e-commerce world. If I went off and started my own e-commerce company, that's something I know how to do. That just takes a lot more time. I don't have a lot of time. I got to stay focused. So I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to reach out to my network. I'm going to talk to people at MicroConf. I'm confident I can give founders that value. And so, it'll be really interesting to see the experience on acquiring customers and then working with them. And I can kind of report back here. Obviously, I'll keep things confidential with the client, but I think it's going to be really interesting.
What type of coaching? What would be the focus of the coaching? Who would this be for? Are you looking to work with SaaS founders, SaaS startups, or e-commerce businesses, or who would you work with?
So I could work with e-commerce because I have experience there, but my comfort zone would be with a SaaS founder, he or she.
Yeah, because I feel like in the past few years, you've been more in the SaaS world than actually growing an e-commerce store. You're selling to e-commerce, but you're not.
Yeah. Right. And if I had an e-commerce business up and running right now, and a lot of that knowledge is transferable, right? But it's not like that. But right now I have a SaaS that's up and running, and a lot of that knowledge is transferable from tech process to how we do standups to how we do marketing. All of this stuff can be really valuable along with the advice and the sounding board and the strategy and all that. So
yeah, like if you heard us talking with Ben and Rock, I think it was like two episodes back, we talked all about the process inside Cardhook, but I think there was probably like this, if you listen to what we were talking about, you could tell that there's a lot of underlying knowledge and experience and trial and error that you guys have clearly gone through and you've learned a ton. We didn't really get into all of the details on that episode, but you could tell like there have been years of learning just underneath that conversation, which would be hugely valuable for anyone who's building up.
So I think that's the comfort zone. You know, SaaS founders who have gotten something off the ground and are now looking to take it to that next level, whether it's from 10K to 20K, 50 to 100, 100 to 200, but whatever that, okay, what got me here is good. And now to get to the next level, I mean, that's the same thing that we did with our coaches. We said, okay, we have things up and running. We've got trials coming in. Now, how do we go from that to a more formal marketing process that's more repeatable? Same thing with we used to be four people on a call. Everything was communicated. Nothing was lost in translation. Now all of a sudden we have 14 people. How do we get our tech process working in such a way that actually keeps 14 people in the loop and so on? So it's just like a leveling up friction that I think I can be helpful.
If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, obviously you know Jordan pretty well and me. But I mean, just these conversations that we have, like I get so much value both on air and we talk a lot off air too, getting your clear cut, honest opinion and, you know, break it down. Like, there've been multiple times I can literally look back on in the past few years where I made key business decisions based off of some of the advice that you gave me. I mean, I'm not just saying that, but
same
it's true.
Advice first also.
And so, you know, listeners to this, I mean, I think there's pretty much no question as to the type of value that somebody like Jordan can bring. So I guess my next question would be like, obviously you're running Cardhook. So what is your goal with this coaching thing? Like how many clients, what type of commitment time-wise, like what are you thinking in terms of that?
What we've done with our coaches has worked really nicely. And it's just 1 hour a week call. Then you can email anytime. And then it turns into almost like this like friendship of, you know, it's almost like a personal mastermind with two people. And so that's what it turns into. I think I can do up to three people, work with up to three founders. And then, yeah, those weekly calls and like...
Are you thinking like weekly or monthly or... Yeah.
No, weekly. Weekly really works for us. Every once in a while, it gets to be like, oh, we're just busy and we just don't do it that week. And then it turns into every 2 weeks, and then it gets busy again. But yeah, yesterday I came to our CTO coach and we're trying to figure out QA. Do we need a QA lead? What does a QA lead mean? And I just brought all these questions to him and it helped me understand, you know, like a few big takeaways. So it's like an hour conversation that then orients me toward the next week of, okay, now we're going to have talks internally in the team. Who should we hire as a QA? Where should they be? Does it matter? So it's like a starting point of like, okay, I kind of have some thoughts, help me solidify. And then all of a sudden I have more confidence to go into the team and say, okay, here's what we're looking for. Here's why a QA lead should really be more focused on the customer and not the engineers. It's not just about what, yes, it passed the test. It should be, yes, it passed the test, but it's not quite doing what I want it to do. It's like these little tidbits of information are great. They're 1 hour calls. It goes by fast. And then you just take that knowledge from it and move into the next week.
I will say though, probably what your coaches were saying about coaching. I mean, I've done a bunch of coaching through the Productize program, and I've done it in a few different ways. And I have found it to be, I mean, really enjoyable. There's no, like, you're right. It does keep you sharp. I feel much sharper and much more connected, and it's refreshing in a lot of ways to be able to dive into somebody else's business. Do it like a deep dive on a coaching call, or I also hop into our Slack, like the members Slack, almost every day and answer some questions there. And that's fun to be able to like break out of my own business and get in there. But I have found that the coaching sessions can be really draining, like energy wise, as the coach. I feel like it's more draining on the coach than it is the person, because like,
look, a lot of times, you know, I do it. I come to them with emotion and I'm like, I'm frustrated. I don't know what to do here. And they need to kind of take that on and just ingest it and help.
I mean, the person is like depending on you, right? Like it's a lot to take on. I mean, I like it, but it's the model that I've chosen to do is to be able to do coaching, but keep it at arm's length so that if I ever get too busy or too overwhelmed, I could pause it or whatever. And the, basically what I offer is only one-off coaching sessions as an optional upgrade on the Productize package. You could buy the course and the community, or you can buy the course and the community plus an hour coaching with me. And a bunch of people do the coaching. I've done a couple hundred of those over the past few years. It's nice because it's like I get to kind of do one deep dive for an hour with someone. We record the call, they keep it. And occasionally they'll come back and we'll do like a second or third coaching call, but it's kind of like as needed, you know, it's not like an ongoing thing. And I like that. Like I usually do a few of those a month. So last year in 2017, for the first time, I tried a different model, which I called Productize Mastermind. And I wanted to kind of try it out to see. It was also like, yeah, I could use a cash spike. I was really investing heavily into the software and everything. So what I did was I sold two group coaching programs. No, I mean one program, but it was two groups, right? The idea was that each of these two groups would have five members in it. They would pay one time for a 6-month program. We meet monthly. They get six calls. It's me plus the five of them. It's like a 90-minute call, and we get a private Slack channel just for that group.
So it was a defined amount of time for 6 months.
Yeah, 6 months. I think I sold it back in like August or September, and then it lasted through like January or February. Again, it was that give and take for me personally. Like at the end of the 6 months, I mean, you know, it sold out and it was a nice cash injection, and it was good to prove to myself that I could do like sell something like that and actually run it.
Were you happy that it was over after 6 months?
Yes, I was happy that it was over. Yep. And I'm really not sure that I would do it again, to be honest. I probably won't, at least not soon. Maybe a couple of things I might have done differently. I might have like squeezed it into 3 months instead of six. But then you kind of have to do two calls in a month instead of one. I just found the calls to be very, very draining. And I had two groups, so I had two of those calls to do every month. And so, yeah, it's like the hour and a half that I'm on the call, but it also kills the rest of the afternoon or the morning, because I'm just shot after that. Like, because I need to give so much mental attention and dig into each individual person's stuff. It was just really tiring, you know? That's not to say that I didn't enjoy it. I still talk to those people, you know, through the community and stuff, but it's...
Look, if you're going to provide value, it's not just talking. It's work. I'm trying to go into it with an open mind and being realistic about it, which is why, you know, it's got to be clearly defined, limited number of people. And then it's an experiment, right? It doesn't lock me in, doesn't lock the other person in. After 3 months, if it's like, okay, we got a lot of value and it's good and we'll kind of need a break, and that's fine.
A lot of the value is just having somebody to be like a sounding board and just give you like an honest, you know, feedback on decision and, you know, gut feel. It's not like, yeah, people want to kind of see results and everything, and results will happen. But as the coach, you know, you're not doing the work for them. You're advising them, you know? So it's, yeah, it's interesting.
It has to be a good match in that way. So anyway, look, if you're hearing this and you are interested in just talking about it, with no commitment, just talking and seeing if it is a good fit, reach out to me. I'll have something set up at jordangall.com. In the interest of efficiency, I'm just going to have, you know, very easy way to just get in touch with me and talk. And you can reach me at jordan@carthook.com or just hit me up on the on Twitter or something. We'll see where it goes. I'll report back.
We got any other updates to talk about or no?
No, I think the only other update, I read Twitter way too often. I don't actually tweet out very often, but I had an experience that I thought was interesting. It's just part of entrepreneurship. I think Tuesday morning, I woke up. I did that stupid thing where you check your phone at 5:30 a.m. right when you wake up, and I got bad news. Bad news, been working on something for a few months, did not happen, got the official no, bummed me out. I feel like over the, you know, past few years, there's so many ups and downs that the first thing in my mind was, okay, that door just shut. Let's see how long it takes for a new door to open. And I just kind of sat there. Let's just see how long it takes. And then I get into the office and one or two good things happen. And then 2 days later, a brand new door just swings wide open. And I was like, that's it, man. You just have to take the bad news and just not let it get to you and just take a deep breath and just say, all right, what's on the horizon? Because something good's on the horizon.
And that's good advice. Good way to think about it. I mean, I feel like probably a lot of us like you, we have so many balls in the air that like those doors, you probably have 5 or 6 doors that you're waiting on answers from, and maybe 3 out of 5 come through, 2 don't come through, but it's like, that's how it goes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I just wrote that in a tweet, basically, you know, one lesson I learned over and over is that when one door gets closed, another gets opened, and that just got like a whole bunch of likes and retweets. So I feel like other people feel the exact same thing happening in their business. Everyone gets bad news. It's just normal. It's just not everything you want works out. Brian, are we gonna put on our genius
Let's do
hats
it.
Of knowing exactly what to do with other people's businesses?
So does he have a website for that? Let me see. Or he might have like a coming soon.
Yeah, let's give an orientation here. Derek Reamer is Rob Walling's previous co-founder from Drip. Derek is now off on his own. He is building a new product that, how would you describe it? Slack with less interruption, or what he's really trying to do?
At this point, we just don't really know exactly what his product will end up being, but it's clearly he's gunning for Slack. It's something to be an alternative to Slack. I think he's focused on development teams. I don't think he's necessarily trying to replace or kill Slack, but I think for those using Slack in a use case around like software development, the premise that he has put out there, he's got a really great introductory blog post about this, or like a mission or whatever he put it, about how like the interruptions from Slack for developers are really annoying, and he's trying to solve that problem. He could probably describe it better than we could, but
well, if you look at his Twitter profile, you'll see the pinned tweet at the top is a blog post talking about the problem. He's not even talking about the solution yet. He's just saying, right, Slack is killing developer productivity and I'm on a mission to fix it. And then here's a blog post. So you can see, I don't know if it's on purpose or not, what he's really doing is saying, here's this hugely popular platform, right? And the word platform in my world is a constant conversation. So what a lot of people in our situation that built on top of Shopify or built on top of Facebook, so there are issues with building on a platform. You get to draft behind it and get that accelerated distribution through the platform, but you're on someone else's platform, so you're not in control of your own destiny. So when I look at this, I see Derek, he could have built on top of Slack.
Yeah, like a modifier for Slack to make it more productive for developers or something like
yes.
that.
Sometimes I want to put something in Slack, but I don't want it to notify anyone. I just want it there for later. Like, don't interrupt what you're doing, but I just want to get it out there so I get it out of my mind and in the public sphere. So there are little things, little apps that you can build on top of Slack, and he's deciding not to do that. And he's saying, no, I'm going to build my own platform, which is more difficult, but has a bigger payoff if you can pull it off.
When I first heard about him doing it, it's pretty impressive that he's going after, isn't Slack like the fastest growing startup like in world history or something like that?
It's the fastest to $1 billion valuation. So key difference, but they are growing ridiculously fast. But I also, I want to challenge one thing though. It's not going after Slack, at least in my eyes.
Right.
It's good to have like an enemy, and it's good to have someone.
Well, I think part of the problem that he's identified here is that Slack is like too global. Like Slack is being used for too many use cases. And if you niche it down, you can really make it a good solution to something. We use Slack, but there are frustrations with it. I also use it for my community, for Productize. There are issues. It's not perfect for that, but a lot of communities use it.
So one of the most interesting parts about what Derek is doing is the building in public. That approach, he literally puts screencasts of him developing. What do you think about that? Because I've never been able to do it, to be that public. It seems to work, but does it attract, like...
This seems to be targeting developers, so I think there's some connection there, right? Get developers watching, get developers using. I mean, that sounds good to me. Derek is not inexperienced when it comes to software development, so putting his chops out there for the world to see, I think there's nothing wrong with that. It would be really cool to see somebody like Derek. I actually bookmarked some of his videos because, like I said, I want to learn to code. I want to watch this guy. I don't know. I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but I like to watch it. You know?
Yes. Pick up a few things. The building in public before something is even launched feels ballsy. Like it's one thing. Like now, I'm so brave. Now I'm more public with what we're doing and our revenue, that sort of thing. But I didn't for a long time because I was either insecure or didn't want to attract competitors before I felt established enough. Here, you're attracting competitors and being in public before you even have a product. But it always feels like the positives outweigh the negatives. And people still don't do it. I still don't do it.
Well, I didn't really read his most recent updates, but he either doesn't know exactly what he's building yet, or he's holding it really close to the vest.
On the actual features and solutions.
I have a sense that he knows what he wants to build. He's doing research calls. Like I responded to his email. I got on a call with him because I use Slack heavily and I use it with developers. So I had a bunch of feedback for him, and he had a bunch of good research, open-ended questions, like not trying to dictate the, that's the mistake that I've seen a lot of people do is like they try to go through the motions of the validation and they get on these calls and they're like, would you like this type of to-do list that does this, this, and this, and in this exact way? Yes or no? Like these leading questions, you know, and I think Derek did a really good job of asking smart, open-ended questions that certainly got me talking. I'm guessing that those calls probably informed his, like how he prioritizes, myself included with this. Whenever I have an idea, I have a pretty good idea of what I want to build from the outset. And then I do go through those motions of interviewing people. And through those interviews and through getting feedback and then maybe doing pre-sales and things like that, that's when I start to whittle down what my original vision was to, okay, it sounds like these are the priorities and these maybe I should scrap those ideas. That's probably what I'm guessing that's the sort of process that Derek has been going through.
Right. Not pure idea validation where you're just going in without an idea.
Yeah. Like I don't think he's idea hunting. I think he has an idea and he's trying to get it focused and prioritized.
Yeah. And this is closely related, not to mix up different businesses and different conversations, but hey, it's our podcast. We do whatever the hell we want, Brian. But this is similar to Write Message that Brennan and Shai are working on. And they're working in public a lot. And watching it is very, very interesting. I know it has affected me watching both Derek and Brennan and Shai and how they're doing things. We are just about to open up a Facebook group, something that we probably should have done a year ago because that's where all of our customers are. But we didn't have the capacity to manage it. And you can't just throw it out there and do nothing with it. You do have to manage it. So as we are opening up a Facebook group, a lot of the questions are, how do we want to do this? What is our tone? What is the aim? Are we just creating this? Do we do support in there or do we not? Are we just going to try to encourage people to run this down their own and back off? And one of the things is, how transparent do we want to be? How public do we want to be about what we're building, what's coming up, what's in staging, what's in development?
What Brendan has been doing with Right Message has been taking that like building in public thing even further than what Derek has been doing. Like I think Derek was getting some feedback through his email list and maybe through some of these videos that he's posting and through his blog. But like Brendan has this Facebook group that is extremely active. I don't know if you're in there.
Is it around Right Message or is it around Brendan?
Brendan like has like multiple Facebook groups. He has one for Drip, around like Drip personal, like Drip Pro Tools personalization. And then I don't know if he merged that or if he has a separate group for Right Message, but then he's also had Facebook groups for like his courses for freelancers. And like, he's super active on them, you know, and he's got a lot of members. So the members are very active in those groups as well. He's just done a really good job of keeping that stuff active and really fostering it. And then actually just posting stuff like hey, here's a new tool we're working on. And here's a new, like he's been showing like rough diagrams of concepts that they're working on and like, you know, mock-ups and things like that. And it's been pretty impressive. I mean, in the early days of Ops Calendar, I guess it's still in the early days because, but the early days I was trying to do something like that. Like I had a Slack group for the prepaid members and I just kind of lost steam with it. I was in touch with them for a couple months there, but then we had to kind of hunker down and build stuff and I got out of touch with them. And then when I tried to get back in touch, they were on to other stuff and it was, so that's, it's tough, but yeah, these guys are doing a pretty good job of it.
I think the only way for us to do it is to go into it with an idea of how we want to do it and then start to explore what's right for us and how comfortable, because I see sharing revenue screenshots is past my comfort zone. You know, and I came across a great tweet by a buddy of mine here in Portland named Derek Wyatt. So he's a marketer here. He wrote or quoted something in a tweet that said, "Never let modesty get in the way of good marketing." And it's like, all right, I definitely let modesty get in the way of good marketing the time.
Me too, all the time.
You feel weird about bragging. It's partly this American mentality. It's partly,
This morning I sent an email to my whole list and like I rewrote the subject line four times because the first one was like, it was totally like, you know, here's some crazy revenue number, whatever. And then I was like, I'm going to back off of that a little bit.
Yes. You know? So that, I think we're wrong. But I don't exactly understand how. So when I see Shai, right, that works with Brendan on Right Message, post hit 150K in ARR, what is the point of that? I don't understand what the point of it is, but it does something inside me that might be the point of it, where it's like credibility, envy, confidence. It's this, you start to root them on. It's a strange mix. I don't get it. I don't understand it.
There's no doubt that people are really attracted to the revenue-based headlines. We see that all the time in blog posts, and especially in these circles, especially in startups and bootstrappers, and like people just, everybody's trying to go from zero to something in some short amount of time, and that's always going to attract people. It's like human nature. Like nobody's immune from that.
Right. And most people don't share. So the people that do, especially if they're successful, it's very attractive, right? Part of the Open Startups Initiative with Bear Metrics is, are you serious? You're just going to let me look at all of your revenue?
Yeah.
And it's
fascinating. But my take on it though, is that like, and part of the reason why I'm not extremely transparent about stuff, like every single revenue milestone, is that like, I think it's just more valuable in the early days than it. I know that people love to see the big numbers after a couple of years, but like, I think it's more valuable to know like, oh, this company went from zero to 10K in this amount of time. That at least like opens eyes in terms of like, oh, that's a thing. Like that thing is not going to just go away. It looks like he's going to continue on with that. Whereas, okay, went from like 100K to 500K, like, okay. Yeah. I mean, I figured you would do that. Like,
think about Mixergy, right? When someone says, yes, you know, I make $400,000 a month, it gives this credence to it of like, whoa, hold on a second. that's pretty serious. I want to learn more.
Right. See, that's the thing. Is like, it's, I do like asking the questions, especially when I do interviews on my other podcast. Like I don't hammer in like Andrew Warner does, but I do try to get a sense of like, all right, tell me like kind of what revenue is or what level is your business at, so that we have a frame of reference for everything else that we're going to talk about in this interview. We're not talking to somebody who's just done $1,000. We're talking to somebody who runs a certain level of business, and that should inform like why we can maybe trust that they've been through the experiences that we're talking about. Posting revenue just for the sake of revenue without any learning behind it or lesson about what changed since the last update, like, I'm not saying it's wrong to do. I'm just saying like that to me doesn't add a lot of value. And then the question is like, does that actually help you get customers for your business?
That's the right question.
I mean, I don't see how that really plays into it, to be honest. I mean,
I don't know. I think depending on the situation, it might. I mean, we have this thing.
I mean, I'm a fan of Brennan's, and I'm interested to hear about his revenue numbers, but I'm not paying for Right Message right now. You know, just me personally, like, I don't know. Like, it's not.
Yeah. So I see what Brennan's doing with it, where a lot of his focus is not on their revenue. It's on the improvements in revenue and conversion rate and so on of his customers. And I think that's where, you know, when I hear him say, we're just working with this customer and they had a 32% lift in leads, that's what I send my marketer, right? That's what I send to Ed. I don't send Ed their revenue. That's like, whatever, it's kind of interesting. But I send like, ooh. That's kind of where we've ended up in our Facebook group thinking, is let's highlight our merchants. Let's say, ooh, we had $750,000 today run through the network. Awesome job, everybody. Right? Because that's like braggy, but not on our own behalf. So it's like kind of more helpful. Anyway.
Maybe getting back to Derek's thing. Yeah, I think he's calling it,
man, is it Level?
Powered by Level.
Yep.
.com or?
That's just the Twitter handle, so I assume it's Level. Okay.
All right, so we'll get it all linked up. But you know, what do you think about whatever it is that he's building in terms of a product, the need? Because I know that you're not technical, but you have a tech team. Do you guys use Slack pretty heavily on the day to day stuff?
We are very reliant on Slack. It is the hub of the entire company. What we've had to do is just adjust and acknowledge that it's not the best place for a lot of things. One of our sayings is, if it's not Jira, it doesn't exist. If it's not in Jira, it doesn't exist. So it's like, oh, cool, you have a complaint. This customer has an issue. That's nice. If it's not Jira, do not complain that it didn't get fixed. So Slack has a place, but there are issues with it. And the truth is, it would be interesting to hear the perspective of our engineers and how it affects their life, because that's very different from the way it affects my life. My context switching is not that big of a deal.
That's probably because we're the founders and it's our job to pay attention to everything. You know, that's something that I actually struggle with almost all members of my team, developers and writers and managers, and especially new people who are being onboarded. Like I am onboarding new people this week. It's like, I know that people are getting notifications from Slack. They're getting notifications from Trello. We're sending emails sometimes. My developers are getting GitHub notifications. I'm always struggling to know, like, all right, which notifications are people actually paying attention to and which ones are they just filtering out? Because everybody filters out something, right? Like, and then the other challenge that I see is that some of my team are not full-time employees. Some of them kind of are. Almost all of them, especially the long-time people, kind of know how important it is to see Slack at least once or twice a day and catch up on any pings. But especially for new people, I'm like, do they totally get that you have to kind of check to see if somebody's trying to message you in Slack? You know, we struggle with that. And same thing with developers. Like, and I hire developers usually on a project basis. So maybe I'm working with someone for 2 weeks straight, but then the project ends and they go off and do their thing. And then a week or two later, I just need them to come back and fix one bug. If I Slack them, have they shut down this Slack since we haven't worked together for 2 weeks? Like, that's where I think my frustration has been. Like, I don't know when somebody's actually going to see this Slack. And then I like kind of resort to email and it's like, all right, well, when should I do which one? And it's tricky.
So if I were Derek, the approach I would take, there's the product and there's the marketing. in the marketing, I think at least the obvious way to go is to just point to the enemy. It's just one of these things where if you can be loud enough, almost to the point where they notice you and are annoyed by you, that's a good way to get attention.
I mean, that's how Slack started too. They were like, oh, we're the email killer.
Right. Email's the worst. Email's the enemy, sort of thing. They didn't have an enemy to name, which makes it more powerful. They didn't say Gmail's the enemy. So this is a situation where you can say Slack is bad for you. So that is kind of like a ballsy, abrasive thing. But I think that could really, really work because you are drafting off their attention and you can go back to a lot of, you can get pressed that way.
I also think that it's smart of Derek that he's meeting his target customers where they already are. They're already on Slack. Like he's acknowledging that from the start. You know, it's not
Slack's great, but
it doesn't sound like he's creating a new product category. Maybe he kind of is, but it's a spin-off off of whatever Slack is.
Right. Slack's great for a lot of people, but for your team, if you have a bunch of engineers and you keep distracting each other, it's actually not good for you. And that's why. So on the product side, my approach to these types of things is parity plus. So blatant, ruthless copying to the point of parity. And then once you get to parity, then add, then change, then look to see what's different. At least that's my gut approach, because there are so many micro decisions in building things. And at least the way we've done it, a lot of times we say, oh, that doesn't make sense the way they built it. We'll build it our way. And then we learn the exact same lesson that they learned, which is the reason they ended up at doing things a certain way.
Yeah, because like customers need to switch over and have a seamless transition, but then still get the benefit of your unique.
Right. And there's a lot of lessons learned on the way there that as a smaller team, to skip those lessons and just climb right on top of the competitor's shoulders, I think that's the right move.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I feel like, you still have to figure out, all right, which features are we not going to build?
Right. But as you're building toward parity, that's when you're talking to your actual customers to say, what are the small changes? What are the two or three big features that we're going to stand on, such as the ability to send a message, but have it only go at a certain time, or mark it as not time sensitive and therefore don't notify people?
I feel like every great product that's in a competitive space has done a really good job of, or some products have done a really good job of, they have like one feature, even if it's a super simple feature, that like defines the reason why most of their customers use them. I mean, I think about like Help Scout. It's super competitive space. There's how many like help desk software is out there. Most of them do more or less the same thing, like ticketing and shared inbox and all this stuff. Now they all kind of do this. But at the time that I first discovered Help Scout, which was years ago, the idea that your customers just see a regular email address and the whole help desk is invisible to them, and then on the backside you have a real help desk, like that was like the magical thing. It's like, oh, that's why I use Help Scout. Like, yeah, they've got notes and tags and automations and reports and all this stuff. But like, yeah, that's expected. That it's a help desk software. It should have that. The reason I found out about Help Scout and the reason why I used it at first and I still use it today is because of that. It's invisible to the customer. Like, I remember Drip. I ended up becoming a paying customer of Drip. I guess it was before workflows came along, but I knew that they were going in that direction. They started doing like rule automation and stuff like that. That was it. Like that was the difference between Drip and MailChimp. And like, you know, you find that one differentiator, you can still build the rest of the features that customers are going to need to have in order to fit this into their workflow. But like, there's one thing that people are going to know you for, you know?
Right. So in that case, it's like, just build Slack, but build it with the ability to do X. So like, it's Slack, but you get to choose who do you interrupt.
I mean, I'm curious to see where he goes with it and what the pricing model will be, especially since Slack is, you know, using freemium and all that kind of stuff. So
they use freemium and they are definitely not an easy company to compete with. They do so many things that are indistinguishable from magic, right? Like that literally, I think they call it a magic link.
Yeah,
just
right.
Go to the ad multiple Slacks. Just the email that you get from Slack billing, that's like, hey, turns out that one person wasn't active, so we gave you a $3.46 credit back to your account. You're like, really? You guys do that? Because nobody does that. So there are a lot of little things that Slack does that are really tough to replicate. So it's gonna have to be good.
There's no doubt though. There are definitely frustrations with Slack, and I'm sure Derek knows that pretty well, better than anyone at this point. So what else do we got? Anything?
I think the only thing we have is that I have a ramen lunch waiting for me with my buddy Jared, who runs a Pointlet here in Portland, and that's the only thing I can think about right now, Brian.
Oh, very cool. I've been a customer of theirs for a while.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Yep. Jared's a good dude. Appointment's an interesting business. Kind of like a Calendly competitor. They do some things differently. Same kind of thing, right? Calendly, like, define a category, and Appointment does a few things differently that make them stand out.
I'm a paying customer of both Calendly and Appointment. I use Calendly for my personal scheduling when I email the link out to people. The only reason I use Appointment is because this is like a weird technical feature, but it's the reason I pay them every month for years, is they give you the option to redirect after a person has booked the appointment. It's actually surprising that not all of these tools do that, but they were one of the only ones, because I have it in my audience ops consultation flow. They request the consultation, they book it in Appointment, and then I automatically redirect them to my page on my site. Some of the other ones just don't do that. And like that was it. Killer feature, you know?
Very cool. Nice, man. All right. That was fun, Brad. Brian, I just called you Brad. Brian.
All right. I'll work with that.
That ramen on my brain, baby. All right, yeah, dude. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening, everybody.
All right. See ya.
Thanks.